Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Willie Porter is a well-known singer-songwriter in Wisconsin. He wrote and performed the Lake Effect theme and lots of other better-known songs and has shared stages with many of the state's other musicians. But much of the reason he landed on the state's musical map is an album that made a national splash 25 years ago.
Tomorrow night at the Pabst Theater, Willie Porter will take the stage, along with original members of his band, to play songs from that record, Dog-Eared Dream. One of those musicians, drummer John Calarco, joined me and Willie Porter in the studio. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mitch.
Well, so let me ask you the obvious question. Does it feel like these songs came out of you 25 years ago?
Not really. I have to say it's all gone by in a blink. How about you, John?
It's unbelievable, actually, thinking about 25 years.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Oh, God.
Well, and can you reflect on, like the changes in your own songwriting in those intervening years? I mean, when you look back at an album that has been part of your, can I call it canon? is there a certain, I don't want to say innocence, but I mean, when I look at stuff that I did 25 years ago, sometimes I'm amazed at how well it went, and sometimes I cringe.
Yeah, huh. Interesting. For me, I think what's interesting about this record is that it represents how hard John and Steve, the rhythm section on the album, really pushed me, because I think I've sort of fallen into my more organic form in the years hence, in terms of how I approach the guitar and how I approach songwriting. So. But this album had a little bit more, I'd say, rhythmic aggression to it in some parts, and it was a little more poppy.
Definitely. I think also there was an innocence in it. You know, we were kind of newbies, and nobody really knew. We knew we had something special with this record, but to the level it got, I don't think anybody imagined.
Well, and you would want it to push you, but you wouldn't want it to not feel like you at some level.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think John hits on a really good point, though, that we weren't thinking about it. You know, it wasn't as though we were trying to get over or trying to do something that was going to connect. We were just playing the music for the sake of the music, and I think that really informed the whole process.
Most definitely. I think that's what people, I believe, although I could be wrong, but they never know with these. But I think that's what people gravitate to, is that honesty, you know, and that there's a sense of rawness and, you know, youthful exuberance. And I think that record kind of captured everybody's thing, you know? I mean, it was funny because I grew up kind of a jazz snob, you know? And it was so funny when we did the record, I walked into the studio and they took all my drums away and they made me play on a kick drum, a snare, and I think, did I even have a floor? Yeah, I had a floor tom.
Yeah,
this is what you're playing on.
Yeah.
Well, and what was your reaction at that point?
You know, it's interesting. I think, you know, when you're young and dumb, the little ego involved is like, whoa, what about me? You know, but it actually was a great thing because it made me be creative on the spot. Okay, what am I going to do? You know, and I think that's how Angry Words came. The groove for that was less was more. I had to make something happen. You know?
Crumpled sheets, two tired bodies, sins I commit now in my head. I have cursed your name a thousand times or more. Your photograph lies deep at the bottom of my drawer. When I looked at it this morning, I had no angry words to say. No angry words to say.
Do you have to be more creative when you have fewer tools at your disposal?
On the drums?
Yeah.
Yes. For tones, you got to be creative for different tones, hitting the drum in a different area, you know, creating kind of a character for each drum. Give it a personality, you know. And his guitar playing is so dynamic that you want to complement what's going on, you know, instead of, you know, trying to take it over, although I fell into that sometimes, didn't I, Willie?
Well, yeah, I think I don't know if you fell into trying to take it over. It was more as though you were kind of trying to push what was there. And I think that's an interesting sort of confluence between the players when they're sort of hearing what the other person is doing, but also trying to sort of do a yes and, raise the game a little bit of what's happening collectively. So that was really the trio, myself, John, and Steve. That's really how we functioned, yeah. I think. And God bless, really the core of the record.
God bless Stevie. I mean, he brought his A game on all that stuff, and it's very signature, that whole record of him, I think.
How present in your mind are those recording sessions?
For me, they're pretty I remember them very well. Mike Hoffman produced, and I think he was such a great den mother from the standpoint that he really listened to the band, listened to what we were doing well, and didn't change what was working. And I think a lot of producers want to put their sound on something, and Mike simply didn't do that. He just realized, you know, if he didn't say something, it was because he liked it, and also because he really thought that it was us. And I think capturing a good photograph of what anybody does musically is a real trick psychologically.
It's funny you use the term photograph, because I was wondering, you know, you are, you know, we're having this conversation, you're getting ready to play a show in which, I don't know if you're playing, are you playing the album in its entirety?
Pretty close.
Okay. For a songwriter, is this a little like going through an old photo album?
Yeah, I think it is in a way.
I definitely think so, because I think we're different players today. And it's kind of interesting going back. For me personally, I don't know about Willie, but well, you still perform a lot of these songs, I believe, right?
Several of them, yeah. I've had for years, but they've morphed and changed. And so in order to play with this ensemble again, it's going back to the original form, which I think is kind of healthy. You know, you get to sort of do your own forensic archaeology.
Yeah. Well, and it's a different context, right? Because when you play a song from that album in among, you know, your entire repertoire, it represents one thing. But when you're playing that same song in amongst all the other songs from that one album, it's something else entirely.
It very, definitely is,
very
yeah.
True.
And
yes.
I think there's a lot of connective tissue that I had forgotten.
Such as?
Well, just the way the melodies were originally written and how they fell, how I sang them. You know, like the Beach Boys, every time I've gone on tour, I drop everything a half step. So what started out as, I'm picking up good vibrations, is now, I'm picking up good vibrations. You know, and it's just, it's part of aging. But also, I think to attack these songs from the perspective of the album and with these players is really a blast.
You talk about aging, and you know, as we all do, but yeah, when you listen back to this, is it something to consider where your voice was 25 years ago?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I think his voice is better today.
You're kind
by far. I think. I mean, it's not taking anything away from the record. I thought his voice was great on the record.
Oh, it's fear, grace within these wings. Oh, to be forgiven, all your memory of sin. Cause we've waited so long to shine, this love is so strong. I'm flying, I'm high.
Well, and it's interesting, I mean, I think about, say, authors, like fiction writers, and they do events about their latest book, and maybe they'll do a reading from it. But when they're at a bookstore, no one is asking them to read from that book that they wrote 10 years ago or 25 years ago. Are songs more timeless than books?
Boy, what a great question. I would suggest no, you know, depending. I mean, if it's, you know, if it's something from the Great American Songbook, possibly, but I don't think my songwriting is going to hold up like Henry Miller's writing, personally.
But it's interesting to think about it, that you know, we take it for granted that when a writer comes out with a new book, he or she is going to talk about that new book, and that's where they are at that moment, whereas songwriters are kind of like a product of everything that they have done to that point, and you could— You know, if you're the Beach Boys, you could put out the next great American album, and people are still asking you to play Good Vibrations.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I mean, if you went over to somebody's house and you guys were all reading something from the latest pop novel, that would be a very interesting party to go to. But conversely, we do go to people's houses and, you know, the latest Radiohead is on or the latest, you know, Imagine Dragons or whatever the case may be. And so that music is the backdrop to other things that happen and therefore imprinted emotionally in a much different way. So I think that might be
a good point. Yeah.
That's a very good point. Yes.
Well, so let me, I have what seems like a pretty basic question here, but I have any number of recordings in my collection that are, you know, remastered. What do you accomplish when you're remastering an old album? Are you righting old wrongs, or is it something even more basic than that?
It's a great question. For me, the remastering actually can help connect the songs to each other a little bit better in terms of how they're equalized and how the album flows. So that's really what I hope to achieve. And Trevor Sadler, who remastered this version, did a great job in taking some studio outtakes from the original sessions as well as bonus tracks and really making them all feel like one landmass, if you will. So that's really what I think mastering can do. It can sort of build connective relationships between the songs.
Definitely. Rounding out the sound,
yes.
You know, cutting off the edges. But personally, I haven't had a record that was eligible to be mastered yet. So.
Except the album Shine. Is
right. So, there, yeah, yeah. This is mastered for the first time, I'm guessing.
Yes. Dog Your Dream, it's not, as far as sales goes.
But so the original studio sessions all exist, and then the producer sits down and says, you know, we could bring this part out a little better than it was originally.
Ah, I see where you're going. Well, your point is good, is a good one, but not from the standpoint of the multi-tracks. That we didn't have access to. So we had the final versions, the stereo mixes. And from there, you can add a bit of bass here. You can compress this frequency range here and sort of bring things out and also open up the sound, maybe broaden the stereo field a little bit. So you can do subtle things that make things better. To me, they're dramatic differences, but to a lot of people, they'd be, you know, like listening to dog tones. They wouldn't necessarily
hear anything below the frequency level. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not saying my ears are great. I just really listen for that stuff.
There's not a before and after we should be playing at this point.
Right.
Maybe.
Yeah, so, of course, if you had the original multi-tracks, that would be remixing, and this is remastered.
Yeah, thank you. Yep.
Yes.
Talk about some of the bonus tracks here, because when you release an album, you know, I think as listeners, we think there are other songs out there, but they didn't make it on the album because you didn't like them or somebody didn't like them or you didn't have room or whatever. Is this a chance to revisit what was good and pure about those songs?
I think so,
I
yes.
definitely think so. You know, I was actually, when Willie sent me the tracks, I actually forgot some of them, you know, and it was really nice to hear him again. It surprised me, you know, how good it was. So I had that was a good experience for me, at least.
Yeah, I think the song Crazy Horse Was Right was a really fun song, and I really loved what it was saying. It was talking about, you know, that a white buffalo had been born and somebody was claiming that it was, you know, the prophecy of Crazy Horse was true. And that was the song that was written or that I wrote after that with Mike Hoffman. Was right. Crazy horse was right. Trust for blankets, got famine dust and small parts, sorted tale of our whiskey won the last. I thought it was a really wonderful piece. For some reason, it didn't make it on the record, which was fine. But then the additional tracks after that were the same band as we went out to L.A. and worked with the great Matt Wallace. And Greg Koch joined us on those sessions. So those were to be part of the follow-up to this record. And so because it was the exact same touring band, they all fit this project, I thought, really well. We all did. And there you have it.
Do you think of this time in your career as, you know, the proverbial sliding doors moment, the, you know, we could have gone this way, but we went this way?
I do. I mean, oddly enough, we were touring through Colorado, you know, on a van tour, playing all of these ski resort towns and so on. And the band we were following through was the Dave Matthews Band. And we both had our first songs on the radio. And we would come through, and I had a killer drummer in John, this amazing bass player, and a great violinist in Biff Blum from Gagnia. And everyone said, there was a band just through here that's an awful lot like you guys, or maybe you're a lot like them. Yeah. We can't really tell.
I don't know if you remember this, but we were playing in Steamboat Springs at a I can't remember the name of the bar, but the owner or the bartender said the exact same thing. You know, he said, you guys sound like a band we had here just last night. And I said, oh, really? I said, what's the name of the band? And he told me, it's Dave Matthews Band. He goes, matter of fact, they're sitting over there. It's like, oh, wow.
So they were still there. Interesting thing, but I mean, it is a sliding door moment. You know, the label that we were on folded up. And as they say, the rest is history. And that's fine. I mean, I think we've done well. We've stayed in this business and made some great music, I think.
Definitely.
And
do you know were people talking to Dave Matthews and the Dave Matthews Band and saying, you know, you sound just like this group that that we were about to have play here?
Well, I remember going up to that table. I can't remember. One of my other bandmates were there. It may have been Steve or may have been Biff. And I can't remember which guy I said, but he was very, you know, nice. And he said, you guys sound great and blah, 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 blah. And that was as far as that went. But next thing you know, under the table and dreaming, right? So that was next.
Yeah,
what
a great songwriter. Amazing. Truly.
Well, you're not so bad yourself.
Oh, thank you.
Willie Porter, John Colarco, thank you both so much. Congratulations.
Hey,
thank
you. Thank
you so much, Mitch.
Thank you very much.
That was Willie Porter and John Colarco. Willie Porter's album Dog Eared Dream came out 25 years ago. Porter and members of his original band will play some songs from it tomorrow night at the Pabst Theater. You can find out more information at WUWM.com.
I said, Rita, I tried to call you. Tim looked at me and he said goodnight. I couldn't hold my tears as I stared up at the stars in the August sky.